Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 390. Just 10 episodes away from episode 400. You know, nothing special planned for episode 400. I don't know if that's sad or awesome, but anyway, it's a cold one outside today. It is April 14th. The actual day I'm recording this is the day it's coming out, or the evening tonight, and it's April 14th, and where I live in Illinois, it is snowing, and they are predicting 3 to 9 inches of snow today, and I just don't know if I can handle it, guys. But as I stare out the window here and I see the flurries flying, I'm in here where it's warm, and I've got a cup of coffee and a world-famous breakfast of a brownie. Yeah, let's just move on from that, huh? This week, I've got two great papers, one from the Illinois Lodge of Research and another one from 1931 about lodge summonses. Doesn't sound great, but there's some really cool history behind it. And so we will read about that and a whole lot more in this episode. I want to thank everyone out there who has gone to WCYpodcast.com and picked up a producer's pin. It's our newest pin. We've kept the symbolism that we have had from the beginning, and we went with a more contemporary design, and of course made by our friend Edgar Alejandro of Masonic Revival. So if you get a chance, head on over there, WCYpodcast.com, and pick one of those up. I've also got some Masons Ladies decals. If your wife or your special lady would like one of those, you can slap one of those on their car. It's kind of a neat sticker. It's a decal, like a real decal. So you peel off the back, you center it, you put it on the glass, wipe it off, and then you peel the other end of it off also. And we've got those for only $5, so we have what we have. I'm not going to make them again, so once they're gone, they're gone. And you can get our book, It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry, from our website. I have 3 or 4 copies left before I run out and I have to order more. But if you buy it from WCYpodcast.com, you'll get the book for $15 plus shipping, and I'll throw a signature in there if you want. And then there's the other way to get that, of course, is on Amazon.com. And if you go to Amazon, it's $15 and free shipping, right, if you have Prime. So it's a cool deal there, but not autographed. Also, we've got that same book on both iBooks and on Kindle. So that's there for you as well. I want to go ahead and give a shout out to everybody out there who continues to support this program through a monthly or one-time donations. Every once in a while, we've got contributors, fellows, and producers who have gone to our website. They've clicked subscribe on payments, and they will sign up for either giving $2 a month, $5 a month, or $10 a month, respectively. And that money goes right into our PayPal account, which is what all of the hosting services and website developers and all those people, they just debit out of that account. So it's kind of an in and out, but what it does, it allows the show to be self-sufficient. So again, a big thanks to all of those guys. If you are a fellow contributor or producer, your name is up on the donors wall on our website. We've got your names up there just as a thank you. Whether you've given once, twice, or, you know, you let it ride for 4 or 5 months and then you had to cut it off for a while or whatever the case is, we really appreciate all of it. So your names are up there, and want to, again, just say thank you to you guys. So now that we've put all the business out of the way, let's get into the meat of this episode right after this.
Hello, Whence Came You fans. This is Brother Joe Martinez from Manassas, Virginia. Your illustrious host, Brother Robert Johnson, has allowed me to take a few seconds of his program to remind you about our very special event, the inaugural Mid-Atlantic EsotericCon, which will be held on June 15, 2019, at Manassas Lodge No. 182 in Manassas, Virginia. This all-day event will include both tiled and untiled presentations from many of your favorite esoteric authors and speakers, to include John T. Ruark, Frater O., Greg Kaminsky, P.D. Newman, Pierce Vaughn, Jamie Lamb, Don McAndrews, and your very own Robert Johnson. Vendors will include the ever-popular Masonic Revival and Ascended Masters clothing. Lunch will be catered, with coffee and snacks available throughout the entire day. Tickets have been selling quickly, and we do have a limited seating capacity, so do not miss out. The Brew Night on June 14th is already sold out, and tickets for the event will be sold until we run out, or April 15th, 2019, whichever comes first. For more information, visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/MAEsotericon, or to purchase tickets, please visit tinyurl.com/MAEsotericon, or search eventbrite.com for Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. If you're looking for a more introspective, thought-provoking, and deeply engaging way to start your summer, look no further than the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. Again, tickets are going very quickly, so get yours today. And as always, thank you to my dear brother, Robert Johnson, for this time to promote what will certainly be an event to remember.
All right, my thanks goes out to Joe Martinez for putting together the information here for us for Esotericon coming up just a couple months away now. I'm very excited about the prospect of doing a con just based on esoterics. I think it will be a fun and engaging way to explore the deeper meanings in Freemasonry. I've been asked a few times what my presentation is on, and it makes some bold statements in the description of what I'll be covering. In short, what my talk will be on is what I would consider the foundation principle of all major religions, as well as the founding principle of the mystery schools throughout history, recorded history that we know of, and moving into today's Freemasonry and other initiatic orders. What is the foundational truth there? And it's this one thing, and guess what? Science proves it. And so we're going to talk about those things. Some flashy keywords that people out there just might love is, of course, quantum mechanics, quantum theory, emergent theory, the double slit experiment, the secret, the law of attraction, Schrodinger's cat, and even modern psychology and the law of thermodynamics and specifically entropy. Now, that might sound like a whole lot of crazy stuff going on, but I assure you, it's tied together, it's fun, it's not too hard to understand of what we're going to go into, but it's a deep dive, it's a presentation that has the ability to affirm what you may have always believed intrinsically within yourself, but it also might have the ability to upset the paradigm that you've kind of lived in terms of your personal philosophy or religion. So it's one of those sensitive topics, but no doubt we'll have fun, and I hope you guys will all enjoy and see me out there at Esotericon. Now, coming up at the end of this month is Masonic Con in Attleboro, Massachusetts. It's going to be awesome. I hope to see you there. We talked about it quite a bit last month, but if you want to know more, you need to go to eb1870.org/masonic-con-2019. If you go there, you'll get all of the pertinent information about the upcoming super awesome Masonic Con. I am not presenting there. I'll have a table there to hang out and talk about some things, and really I'm going so that I can see all of the awesome presenters and share in some fellowship with my brothers of Ezekiel Bates. Now, let's get into these papers. This first paper comes from Brother James Tome. Now, James Tome, when he wrote this, I don't know that he knew that he would be the master of the Illinois Lodge of Research at some point. I don't know that he knew he would be the excellent high priest of the state of Illinois at some point. However, he was both of those things. And he wrote this one, and it comes from the Illinois Lodge of Research, volume number 21, page number 48, and it's called Speaking to the Bees. It's no wonder that operative Masons came to see bees as beings of similar spirit, culture, and intent. Bees have long been symbols of industry, stability, regeneration, wisdom, and obedience. The bee works hard and tirelessly, not for herself, but for the benefit of the hive. She has a knowledge of material and process, and works in cooperation with others. She is protective of her leader, or queen, opposes the admittance of enemies to the hive, and lives in a society governed by law and order. From ancient times, bees and their beehives have been important symbols and elements in almost every culture on Earth. The very term industry, from an ancient perspective, referred to the employment of a very large number of men, tens of thousands in some instances. Individually, each man had his set task, and together, they accomplished much more than any one person could possibly do. Thus, the beehive is that perfect emblem of the power of industry, where the group works together toward a common goal. According to Hierapolo, an ancient Egyptian scholar and grammarian, and attributed author of the Hieroglyphica, a set of two books explaining early Egyptian hieroglyphs, quote, "Of all the insects, the bee alone has a king," end quote. While the bee's society is matriarchal, this particular gender reference may refer to the Egyptian pharaoh, King Menes, founder of the first Egyptian dynasty, who bore the title of beekeeper, as did all subsequent pharaohs. The bee was seen as a divine symbol in ancient Egypt, Egyptian society, bridging the living world and that of the dead. References to bees can be found in Hindu mythology, where they also represented our strongest bond to the material world. It was believed that eating honey would ensure good health and fortify one's spirituality. Like other cultures, the Greeks held the bee sacred and featured it prominently in their mythology. Honey was believed to be the food of the gods, and that bees were a part of the everyday lives of their gods. Zeus was said to be raised by bees, earning him the title Meleceus, or Bee-Man. 3rd century Greek philosopher Porphyry of Tyre believed souls descended to earth in the form of bees from the moon, lured to a life on earth with promises of honey and other delights. Ironically, honey was also a symbol of death and offered to the gods. This dualistic nature of honey is no coincidence. Both the honey and its maker, the bee, represent the cycle of existence. As the bee returns to the hive, so the spirit returns to the maker. Their tendency to suddenly appear made them become symbols of death and rebirth, in some ways representing the immortality of the soul. In Roman times, the emperor and philosopher Marcus Aurelius coined the phrase, quote, "What is not good for the swarm is not good for the bee," end quote. There's a great deal of wisdom in this statement that we can see in Freemasonry. The good of the craft stems from the satisfaction and industry of the individual workman. In the Jewish and Christian legend, bees have had various meanings representing industry, fidelity, and virtue. According to the book of Luke, the first food eaten by Christ after his resurrection was honey. Luke 24:41-43, quote, Jesus said, "Have you got nothing to eat?" And they offered him a piece of broiled fish and a honeycomb, which he ate. End quote. By several accounts, the bee was associated with the sound that high priests in the Temple of Solomon heard while in the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. It is said that Aaron, brother to Moses, heard the sound of bees humming while hearing the secret name of Yahweh in the presence of the ark. In fact, there is some thought that hives are a type of ark, and thus also take on the similar representation of regeneration that the ark does. Bees reportedly make a humming noise at midnight, when the birth of our Savior took place. As a result, ancient beekeepers would visit their hives on Christmas Eve in the hopes that the bees would be humming or singing, a sign of good luck for the coming year. The bee is altruistic to a fault. St. John Chrysostom, the 4th century Archbishop of Constantinople, known for his eloquence and public speaking, wrote, quote, "The bee is more honored than other animals, not because she labors, but because she labors for others. Indeed, the bee works unceasingly for the common good of the hive and obeys without question what appears to be an inequitable hierarchy," end quote. Another organization that is commonly and mistakenly affiliated with Freemasonry is the infamous Illuminati, or the Aura of Perfectibilists, a conspiratorial secret society founded by German philosopher Johann Adam Weishaupt in 1776. 2 years after establishing the order, Weishaupt proposed renaming the order to the Order of the Bees, complete with changing their secret keywords to those with a bee theme. This proposal may have been likely due to his new Masonic affiliation. He was initiated into the Masonic Lodge Theodor zum Guten Rath at Munich in 1777, and our fraternity's affinity for the ideals of the Bee Society organization and purpose. Weishaupt was also a student of the Greek mysteries, which are heavily laden with bee symbolism. The goal of the order was a single world government, which some interpret more ominously as world domination, and its organization consisted of a network of spies and counter-spies acting independently yet connected to each other in a cell-like relationship structure, with each cell reporting to an unknown superior. From this time forward, one can see the beehive as a metaphor for control of the masses or proletariat, a word in Latin referring a working class in Roman society whose only contribution was their offspring. The definition seems especially appropriate considering the typical beehive can contain thousands of newborn bees. More directly, for the simple beekeeper, the bee was well respected. She worked industriously, tirelessly, and cleverly on behalf of her master, asking nothing in return. In other words, the beekeeper was indebted to the bee and had an attitude of gratitude toward them. Beekeepers would often speak to the bees, according to folklore, telling them things they thought necessary, especially births, marriages, and deaths. Bees were thought not to be able to prosper in an atmosphere of anger or hatred. In fact, there was a fear that upset bees would swarm and leave their hive, leaving the beekeeper alone without his hive to care for if news was not whispered into their hives. For this reason, the phrase telling the bees came into being, and bees were thought of as messengers of the spirits, being able to pass messages to friends and relatives who have passed into the afterlife. The bee is an important symbol of Freemasonry and was especially common in Masonic drawings and documents of the 18th and 19th century. The beehive has been adopted by Freemasonry as the appropriate emblem of industry, a virtue taught which says that a master mason, quote, works, that he may receive wages the better to support himself and family and contribute to the relief of worthy, distressed brother master masons, their widows and orphans, end quote. Very bee-like indeed. Bees have an intrinsic reverence for authority, a trait important in the teaching and very structure of Freemasonry. No bee dares leave the hive to swarm to another location unless the queen has gone forth in front of them and claimed the rank of first flight for herself. In many ways, we can see the similarity in our organization with its ideology of respect and privilege, but also structure and order. While man was created independent of all other beings, his dependence on society means he depends on other men for protection and security. He is an individual creature whose personal contributions to a greater society are critical to the survival of society as a whole. Freemasonry, then, is like a queen bee whose workers have built a hive and now search for the nectar of choice flowers to bring back and turn into honey for the nourishment of all. According to our Masonic instruction, the Mason is directed to, quote, go to the bee and learn how diligent she is and what a noble work she produces, whose labors kings and private men use for their health. She is desired and honored by all, and, though weak in strength, yet since she values wisdom, she prevails. End quote. Could this reference to the bee's individual weakness refer to inadequacies of the single man who, when combined with other of the like mind and given direction and purpose, find success in their undertakings? This interpretation of the bee and her hive mirrors that of the individual Mason and promise of success he enjoys as part of his Masonic organization. The instruction goes on to say, quote, the beehive is an emblem of industry and recommends the practice of that virtue to all created beings. Thus was not man formed for social and active life, the noblest part of the work of God, and he that will so demeaneth himself as not to be endeavoring to add to the common stock of knowledge and understanding may be deemed a drone in the hive of nature, useless member of society, and unworthy of our protection as Masons, end quote. Again, a reference here to hard work, dedication, and the practice of a life under the direction of our deity. Failing to live a life by these means, perhaps a life as a non-Mason, risks being branded worthless by society, and certainly not worthy of being a Freemason. Like the bee that collects nectar from many flowers and turns it into the nourishing honey, we should endeavor to do the same, taking whatever we can and transform it through our labor into a superior element useful to us and the craft. There you have that piece. You know, one of my favorite parts of the ritual always speaks to me. Brother James actually quoted it at the end of that paper. And it really speaks to how we're supposed to be industrious and to always be working and to add something to the common stock of knowledge for humankind. So every time I think about just sitting on the couch and watching television, I think, what else could I be doing? How can I help? What can I do? And then I'm back up at my computer, or I'm headed out to a store, or heading to a lodge meeting, or whatever I can do. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed. All right, wasting no time. We don't need to support the show, right? We've already kind of gone through that, but just another mention. WCYpodcast.com. Check out the different ways to support the show other than just straight donation. We have a number of affiliates that you can check out on our website. Of those, just a quick rundown, of course, being Bankers Best. So if you go click through our link to get there, use the promo code BB, as in Bankers Best, WCY, like the podcast, 357. So BBWCY357, and you'll get a percentage off. We've also got affiliates with Onnit Labs, specifically Alpha Brain, really awesome stuff, and Intellectual Linear Progression, which is a great books program from Brother Scott Hambricht, one of the best. So check those out on WCYpodcast.com. Click on More, and then click on any number of the extras we've got there for you. So this next piece, the final piece for this week, is called The Summons. The Summons sounds weird, right? Like at the end of every Masonic meeting, at least here in Illinois, and I've heard it in most other jurisdictions, the verbiage is similar, but it's something along the lines of, I now declare this lodge closed until its next stated meeting, unless sooner or specially convened, in which case a due and timely notice by summons or otherwise will be given. So we say we're going to meet at the next stated meeting, right? Like, so lodges might meet, say, on the first Monday of every month, and maybe it's that stated meeting, and they're essentially saying that we're going to meet again on that next stated meeting, that next Monday, unless we have a reason to meet before. And if we do have a way to meet before or a reason to, we're going to send out a summons. So that might be, in the old days, a letter. Today, it might be a phone call, an email, or, you know, one of those robocalls. And that's kind of where we leave it. But this paper from 1931, from the Short Talk Bulletin number 3, volume number 9, March, goes into a little bit more detail. Let's check it out. The summons. Every Master Mason understands that a summons is a command to attend the communication of the lodge for which the summons is issued, for the occasional funeral, trial, cornerstone laying, or other function to which he is bidden. Every Master Mason knows why he must, quote-unquote, do answer make, either by attendance or submitting an acceptable excuse, such as an illness, absence beyond the length of his cable toe, or other inability to be present. The summons appears to be very old, older perhaps in civil law than in masonry, and it has there no considerable antiquity. Indeed, while the word does not appear in the Old Testament, both Numbers and Deuteronomy set forth instructions as to the testimony of witnesses at trials, and by implication, if not by detailed statement, indicate that the presence of such witnesses was compulsory. Funk and Wagnall's Standard Bible Dictionary states that the Israelites, quote-unquote, summoned witnesses. Civil summons was known in Rome, first by word of mouth, later by written citation to appear. In Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, written about 1386, is a sampour, or summoner, to the ecclesiastical court. The use of summons in English procedure goes back into the dim distance where fact and mysticism meet. It was part of the feudal system of England and the clan organization of Scotland. When the baron in England or the laird in Scotland summoned his fiefs and retainers, they answered in person. Failure to do so meant death. The safety of the baron depended upon absolute fealty. The safety of the realm depended upon prompt obedience of the laird to the call of the king. But importance of obedience to summons goes further back than that. When King Arthur founded his mystic, if not mythical, Knights of the Round Table, one of the inflexible rules was that every knight must appear on a fixed day in every year to report to the table his acts and adventures of the past year. Only one excuse other than death was acceptable: that the knight was on a quest that so required his attention as to render it impossible for him to appear. He was then expected to send an excuse for his disobedience of the requirement. In the Anderson Charges of 1772, we read, quote, "In ancient times, no master could be absent from the lodge, especially when warned to appear at it, without incurring a severe censure." End quote. In the Constitutions of the Cook manuscript about 1490, we are told that the masters and fellows were to be forewarned to come to the congregations. All the old records and the testimony of writers since the revival show that it was always the usage to summon the members to attend the meetings of the General Assembly or the particular lodges. In the United States, the use of the summons grows rarer with every passing year as applied to a whole membership. In certain jurisdictions, the master summons his lodge once a year, as much, perhaps to keep the idea of the summons alive, as to assemble the whole lodge for any purpose. Occasionally, lodges are summoned regularly twice a year, a custom which doubtless grew out of the original once-a-year summons to come and pay dues, when such particular lodges decided to receive dues every 6 months. In some jurisdictions, the summons is used for the whole membership only upon extraordinary occasions, as when it is proposed to finance a temple or consider some extremely important question of policy, such as giving up a charter. In many jurisdictions, a lodge can not legally give or surrender its charter without the action being considered by the whole membership at a summons meeting. Most jurisdictions would commonly use the summons to command witnesses at a Masonic trial. In some, the master uses the summons to get a sufficient number of brethren present for Masonic funerals. Unhappily, the press of modern life, the casual manner in which too many regard their masonry, the laxness of some masters, and the laissez-faire policy of some Grand Lodge leaders has allowed the sanctity of the summons to be somewhat tarnished. A Mason is Masonically bound to do answer make to a summons. Failure to answer a summons, then, is a Masonic offense for which the offender may be tried. But few who are interested in their lodge's desire to see Masonic trials held, if they can, by any possibility, be avoided. Lodge trials often produce lack of harmony and disunion among the membership. To prefer charges and stage a trial for the apparent trivial offense of a failure to answer a summons is sometimes held to be unwise. Yet, not always so. From 100 instances, one is chosen at random. The Grand Master of Louisiana wrote a letter to the master and wardens of a certain lodge, which read in part as follows. Brother R. Norman Bauer, DDGM, has reported to me that the proceedings of your lodge in the matter of a trial of Brother Blank. My attention is especially called to the fact that out of a membership of more than 200, only 75 brothers answered the summons to be present at the trial. You are hereby directed to require of the brethren who were absent to give a proper explanation of their failure to be present, and in the event satisfactory explanation is not given, you are directed to have charges filed against each of them who fails to provide you with satisfactory explanation. The charges are to be un-Masonic conduct in failing to obey the summons of a lodge in accordance with their obligation and in accordance with the requirements of Masonic law. End quote. Into the question as to when it is wise and right to prefer charges for failure to answer a summons, and when the best interests of all are served by a mere reprimand to the guilty absentees, this paper cannot attempt to go. But it may be said that while failure to answer a summons may be deemed trivial, violation of an obligation cannot be so considered. Those who look at the matter from this standpoint say that some disciplinary action is the only wise course to pursue. It is not possible to blame modern conditions with all of our troubles. It is only fair to say that sometimes disrespect for law is caused either by the law or by the lawgiver. Grand Lodges themselves have not always looked very far ahead in legislating upon the summons. The General Regulations of the Craft, 1721, specifically state, quote, "The master of a particular lodge has the right and authority of congregating the membership of his lodge in a chapter at pleasure upon any emergency or occurrence, as well as to appoint the time and place of their usual forming." End quote. The regulations also specifically say, quote, "Every annual Grand Lodge has the inherent power and authority to make new regulations or to alter these, for the real benefit of this ancient fraternity, provided always that the old landmarks be carefully preserved." End quote. It is, then, perfectly within the power of a Grand Lodge to set up a new regulation regarding summonses or, quote-unquote, right to congregate the lodge.
In some jurisdictions, this has been done, and the right of summons shared between the master and the lodge, that is, the master may summons when he thinks it is wise, and the lodge can issue summons when he thinks wise. But, as has been proved often in the past and probably will again in the future, the power to set up a regulation is one thing, to make it right or even legal is another. It is practically universal that a master has complete charge of the work of his lodge. He is responsible for what it does. He opens and closes it at his pleasure. He says when degrees are to be conferred, he controls absolutely the debate on any question and can close it, curtail it, initiate it as he thinks wise, and can put, or refuse to put, any motion which, in his judgment, is subversive of the peace and harmony of the craft. A lodge can only act as a lodge as a result of a master's order, or of its own order, that is, its vote. If a lodge would spend money, a motion must put and be voted upon. If it would receive a petition, the motion to receive must be put and balloted upon. If it would call off during a summer month, a motion to call off a stated communication is put and balloted upon. This is, of course, if the Grand Lodge permits calling off. Hence, in a jurisdiction in which the Grand Lodge has vested power to issue summonses in the lodge, as well in the master, the lodge must vote upon the question which must be put. If a master refused to put the question up, quote-unquote, shall the lodge issue a summons, the lodge could not vote upon it. If then some brother feeling aggrieved should appeal from this failure to put the question to the Grand Master or the Grand Lodge, that higher authority would have to rule upon the right of a master to control his work. If such an authority desired to discipline the master for failure to permit the Grand Lodge's other behest, the power of a lodge to summons to be exercised. Let nothing in these words be construed as a criticism of the Grand Lodges, which in their wisdom have altered the original general regulations, and given to lodges as well as to their masters the right to summons. A Grand Lodge is supreme with its jurisdiction, no matter how inconsistent with laws, usages, customs, landmarks, constitutions, or immemorial practices of the fraternity its enactments may be. Within its jurisdiction, what a Grand Lodge says is law, and therefore right, or right, and therefore law. In jurisdictions where the Grand Lodge has ruled upon any matter, that matter has been rightly decided for that jurisdiction. Aye, even if the Grand Lodge has ruled that black is white, in this connection, it is interesting to read that actions of Grand Lodge which has decided this matter one way and then the other. In 1834, the Grand Lodge of the District of Columbia decided that a master has not the exclusive right to summons the members. In 1909, a proposed bylaw of a constituent lodge was referred to the Grand Lodge Committee on Bylaws. The proposed law read, "Whenever the lodge is called upon to attend the funeral of a deceased brother, the worshipful master shall summons a sufficient number of the resident members of the lodge, naming them in regular alphabetical order, and a brother so summoned shall be present, or furnish an acceptable substitute. No brother attending a funeral in obedience to a summons shall again be called upon until his name is reached in regular order." End quote. The Committee on Bylaws reported that the Lodge had no right to pass this bylaw in spite of the ancient decision of 1834 on the ground that while lodges have the right, subject to the Grand Lodge approval, to fix the time and place of their stated communications, they have neither right nor power to legislate as to the time nor place of special meetings, which are wholly under the control of the master. In concluding its report, which was unanimously adopted by the Grand Lodge and thus became the law in the District of Columbia, superseding the decision of 1834, the committee said, quote, "The master has the sole authority to convene his lodge in special communications. He may compel the attendance of the members by summons. He alone can exercise this power, and in its exercise he is not subject to the will of the lodge because he is the judge of the exigency or emergency that may require a special meeting. These powers are inherent in the office of master, and no bylaw is needed to validate their exercise, and none is legal which attempts to curtail, control, or direct them. That their exercise has been entrusted to the master alone is doubtless due to the fact that the Grand Lodge looks to him and not to the lodge to see that the business of the lodge is properly conducted." End quote. There is good Masonic authority for this decision, which, of course, is law, only in jurisdictions which have so ruled. Mackey's Masonic Jurisprudence states, quote, "No motion to adjourn or to close or to call from labor to refreshment can ever be admitted in a Masonic lodge. Such a motion would be in interference with the prerogative of the master and could not therefore be entertained. The master has the right to convene the lodge at any time and is the judge of any emergency that may require a special meeting. Without his consent, except on the night of the stated or regular communications, the lodge cannot be congregated, and therefore any business transacted at a called or special communication without his sanction or consent would be illegal and void. End quote. Simons, Principles of Masonic Jurisprudence, says, "It is an immemorial usage, and therefore a landmark, that none but the master, when he is present, can congregate the brethren. Under this prerogative, the master may call or summon a meeting of his lodge at any time he thinks is proper. The summons can be issued by authority of the master only, while he remains in discharge of his functions, and is the peremptory order which must be obeyed under the penalty unless the excuse of the defaulter be of the most undeniable validity. In one jurisdiction, where it is held that the lodge as well as the master may issue a summons, failure to answer a summons is treated with first a merciful, then an iron hand. The brother who is summoned but does not answer is resummoned to the next communication of the lodge. If he does not then answer with a valid excuse, he shall be put to trial, and if found guilty, may be reprimanded, suspended, or expelled in the judgment of the lodge. Any intelligent student of Freemasonry must have noted that its jurisprudence is largely concerned with what may be done rather than what may not, with duties and responsibilities rather than prohibitions and penalties. The gentle way of Masonry is to set up the right and believe that every brother will adhere to it rather than the wrong, forbidden under penalty of some punishment. The best way to recreate the old respect which Masons had for a summons is not by trial and punishment, but by education and persuasion. The vast majority of men are honest. Most brethren want to do what is right. Most Masons want to live up to their obligations, perform their duties, give as much as they get. The exceptions stand out more because they are exceptions than because of their number. In a certain jurisdiction in which it is customary to summons the membership once a year, masters have long been distressed because so many members ignore the summons. One master believes that members ignore the summons from the lack of understanding of its importance and their own obligation to answer it. His lodge has 191 members. He wrote 191 letters to go with yearly summons. The letters were short, but they were cordial, personal, brotherly. They explained what the summons was, why it was issued, the duty of the brother to, quote-unquote, do answer make, and closed with the assurance of the masters, certainly, that there was no question of its being answered once it was understood. 165 members answered in person. 21 replied by letter, giving good reason why they could not come. In large lodges, the summons may be all but an impossibility. A lodge with 1,000 members could not crowd them into the usual lodge room if all responded to a summons. Summons, by such lodges, presupposes a special and sufficiently large place in which to meet. Lodges with widely scattered members, as in small towns, in large and sparsely populated states, may make the summons a real hardship on members who may have to travel long distances to answer. It is for such reasons as these that the summons is used less and less, merely because it is not possible to use, and more when it is used for only vital and essential matters. Whether used once a year or oftener by Grand Lodge rule, or seldom and only by the discretion of the worshipful master, respect for the summons may be inculcated by education, by talks in lodge, by letters accompanying the summons, and by word of mouth communication from the member to member. Enforcement by Masonic trial and punishment is essential when Grand Lodge so orders, unless it is mandatory. The gentler way will usually be found the wiser and the more effective, because it is more Masonic. Well, there you have the paper on the summons. Mind blown in some instances. You know, I used to read my lodge's old bylaws that they set up, and if you missed a meeting, they would actually charge you money, like a penny for every missed meeting. And this is in 1849, 1850, all the way up to like the 1860s, until I think they doubled the fine for missing a meeting, and then eventually it fell off. But I do find it interesting that in such cases, we are so lax in the Masonic obligation. At a new lodge that I'm part of, we have less than 25 members. So 1 week prior to the meeting, everyone gets an email. And I say, please respond if I can have your attendance at this meeting. If they don't respond by, say, 3 or 4 days before the meeting, I'm texting them. And if they don't respond to that, I call them. And I get a RSVP from everybody. And I must say This is a very effective way of ensuring your members know the importance of the meeting. But it's not important for us because we need them there. Like, it's not for that reason. We need them there because the lodge is literally not complete without them. It's not like even those members who are not an officer, we're such a tight-knit of gentlemen that we generally care for and love each other so much that our lodge experience is not complete if they're not there. So most of the time, our members will send back a message or give me a call and say, you know, I can't make the meeting because I just had the baby. I've got a last-minute work emergency, or you name it. I mean, they're all acceptable excuses. None of my guys, and that's just for my lodge, right? But none of my guys ever say, oh, you know, the new thing premiered tonight, and my wife and I are going to watch this thing. Yikes. Yeah, it's on Netflix. That can wait, right? We can't redo the meeting. And I think most Masons get that. And so my hope is that the really great takeaway from the paper is how to educate and talk to people, really, rather than drop the iron hammer, as was alluded to in the paper. So a wonderful paper, I thought, slightly dry toward the three-quarter mark. However, I just really like hearing about how seriously we take Freemasonry. And I also take it very seriously when I read papers of old, 1931, almost 100 years old, that there is that laissez-faire, as he put it, attitude towards a summons or coming to a stated meeting. I don't like that attitude at all. I've been called elitist, right? Maybe that's the elitist in me. I believe that a lodge should be tight-knit, smaller, and work together and talk to each other in between meetings and be real friends. As a wonderful doctor put it when I was down in Kentucky doing a talk once, he had a wonderful observation, and he said, it's really hard to care about Brother John Paul Jones when I don't know Brother John Paul Jones. And in this instance, John Paul Jones is just, you know, blank name, right? For a member of his lodge that's never shown up in 10, 15 years, 5 years, 3 years, doesn't really matter. If you don't know them, you can't care about them. And so maybe that's not the lodge for them. I don't know. But it is an interesting thing to contemplate. The importance of the meeting, the importance of being in active communication with the lodge officers, the secretary in particular, about whether or not you can make the meeting, because whether or not you can make the meeting determines whether or not the meeting can happen. Everybody always does this thing that they say, well, I won't go, and nobody will miss me if I don't go this time. Well, if enough people say that, they're not considering other people, right? How many times have you thought, I'm going to call into work today, I need a mental health day, and then maybe you have a job that's really difficult, right? You're the only person who does it, you're part of a small team, and you think, gosh, and you call in, and your boss says, you can't call in, so-and-so already called in. It's kind of like that. Don't call in, just go. Anyway, those are just my opinions. I am no Masonic expert, but thank you for indulging. And if you fast-forwarded through that, that's okay too. That's it for this week. I hope you all enjoyed. Remember, end of the month, Masonicon at Ezekiel Bates. In a couple months, we're going to Manassas, Virginia for Esotericon. There's other things coming up this summer that you're not going to want to miss. I would really encourage you all to check out some of the Masonic cons that are going on. One in particular is going to be very big, and it's on the West Coast. But that's all I'll say for now. Presentations coming up. Again, I will be at Masonicon, not speaking, just hanging out. So stop by, say hi. We can grab a beer together or something. And then May 16th is my next presentation. I'm going to do Esoterics 101 right here in my home jurisdiction at Milburn Lodge, number 127 in Lake Villa. We've got a wonderful group of brothers there. I know most of them very personally. Currently, the worshipful master, Brother Jay Tressenreiter, is the master there. He is one of the most understanding, brotherly, adept dudes I know. Milburn Lodge, 127. Anyway, that's it for this week. Again, hope you all enjoyed. Thanks for supporting the program. Thanks for doing all that you guys do in spreading Masonic light. Thanks for sharing this. Please remember to like and subscribe us on YouTube. Like the videos, subscribe to it, tell your friends, tell your brothers. If we can get to a certain number of likes, then we get access to some pretty sweet content on YouTube, and we get access to tools, physical things. We can go to cities and use studio space and things for special occasions and special episodes and the like, if we get a certain number of subscriptions on YouTube. So please check that out. And with that, I'd like to say have an awesome week, and we'll talk to you all next time. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.